Good morning, everyone. It's good to see you. Thank you for coming and getting up early and making it here. Hopefully we'll have an interesting time together as we explore this massively contemporary and important issue of people on the move around the world, migration in all its many forms. Here's a quotation to start us off with. It comes from the United Nations, from the International Organization for Migration's latest report. And they just make the point that migration is as old as humanity itself. Throughout history, people have migrated in search of better lives, to flee conflict, to seek safety, or simply to find new opportunities. Migration is a normal part of the way that people operate within the world, moving for various reasons. Often in our public discourse about this, we tend to be thinking about migration in these kind of terms. People coming on small boats, the mountain of life jackets on the beaches in Greece, the camps that people stay in, the razor wire along the borders. I think that image comes from the Hungarian border. The ship where asylum seekers have been housed in the UK when they have got here. I don't know if any of you have seen the movie that's there on the right-hand side, The Swimmers, but for me that's one of the best films about migration I've seen. A wonderful story of two young women leaving Syria at the outbreak of war and travelling that route across Europe, across borders, across the Mediterranean in a small boat and finally reaching Germany, where one of them goes on to compete in the Olympics for the refugee team as a swimmer. All these things are the way we think of migration. But that's not all there is to the story. Returning to the UN report, they say it may surprise people that most migration is regular, safe and orderly, regionally focused and often directly connected to work. Not everyone who is on the move is a refugee, is someone desperate. Sometimes people move for other reasons. And that's all part of the picture. The latest statistics that United Nations have got about people on the move date back to 2020. And if you can cast your mind back to 2020, that wasn't a typical year, was it? And yet, even in that year, the year of COVID, 281 million people were on the move. International migrants, that's people crossing international borders, for one reason or another. And that amounts to 3.6% of the world's population on the move in that year. Now, the next set of statistics are due to come out towards the end of this year, and it'll be really interesting to see whether there's been a big bounce up after those restricted times of COVID or whether it'll be roughly the same. But 3.6% of people, this is not an unusual experience. This is something that many, many people have as part of their lives. Thinking about safe and orderly migration, one of the things which we're all aware of that has been part of the British picture over the last few years is special visa schemes for people to come in for one reason or another. So, for instance, visas for people fleeing the war in Ukraine. 203,000 people have so far arrived in the UK under those visas in a safe, orderly, legal way. In terms of Hong Kong, you might be aware of the special visa arrangements available for people with certain types of passports in Hong Kong. And so far, 144,000 people have arrived in the UK on those visas. This is people coming into our country, bringing their experience, bringing their challenges as well. A few more statistics to help us position all of this. People moving for work or study. 265,000 non-British people work for the NHS. It would not work without them. And many of us will have been helped by non-British people working in the NHS. 55,000 seasonal worker visas are given for agriculture each year. People coming to pick fruit, people coming to help with poultry, that sort of thing. Again, these are jobs that people in the UK don't want. And so seasonal visas are given to people coming to do this kind of work. And then look at that next figure, 679,000 international students, more than 500,000 international students in the UK in universities. And that's a figure from 2022. It has been hit recently by changes in visa regulations, but that's a massively significant element in our university population and the student population in our towns and cities. And then I thought it'd be good to look at another form of migration, people who travel on mission. So about 1,500 missionaries have come to the UK to bring the gospel to the godless West, from Africa, Asia, and the Americas. And that's a statistic from the Operation World website. Now, that's obviously just going to be an estimate. Not all of those people will register with someone to say that's why they're here, but at least that many people are here as missionaries to the UK. Mission and migration are closely linked. Here's a quotation from Martha Fredericks, one of the experts on this issue, and she says, "Mission as a byproduct of migration may have been as important for Christianity's diffusion around the world as intentional missionary work." So what she's saying, it's not just people who go as missionaries who are spreading the gospel when they go. It's people who are migrating for other reasons as well. People migrating for work, people migrating for marriage, people migrating for study. In many, many cases, people are taking the gospel with them, and migration has been as significant in spreading the gospel as intentional missionary work. And that goes right back through history as well, as we shall see. But then she complicates that picture and says, when we think about the history of mission and migration, we need to recognise it hasn't always been done well. So if you look back to the times when mission was entangled with colonialism or entangled with empire building, and when all kinds of harmful things were brought alongside the gospel, we need to wrestle with the fact that we need to do this well. When we look at the reasons why people might be moving from country to country, we can think of them in terms of push factors and pull factors, things that push people out of the country where they have been living, make life difficult or intolerable there, or things that attract people, that pull people in. And here's just a few that I could think of. You'll probably be thinking of others even as I'm speaking. So people sometimes leave their country of origin because of war, like those girls in the film The Swimmers, like the people leaving Ukraine and other situations. People sometimes leave their country because of climate change, because it's now become impossible to farm where they used to live, and they need to move. They need to move, and sometimes they need to move across borders. That also is a push factor. Sometimes it can be a matter of persecution. Yes, Christians may be experiencing that, may be pushed out of their country because of persecution against Christians, but people can be persecuted for other reasons as well. Political allegiances, identity issues, racial issues. People will be moving because of persecution in their country of origin. So these are all push factors. And then the pull factors, these are things like opportunity. Freedom. I want to be able to be free to express my religion. I want to be able to be free to live the way I want to live. Pull factors also include things like family, people joining family members in another country, people going from border across borders to marry or whatever, and work and study, as we've already seen. And then we've got this kind of complicated one in the top right-hand corner, trafficking. These are people who are told, perhaps, that they'll be going to get opportunities, but when they get to the place where they're sent, they find that actually that's not an opportunity at all, it's slavery. And so there's kind of a, it looks like a pull factor, but actually it's something much, much more negative. So these are the kinds of reasons why people are on the move in such great numbers. And as you can see, with that range of different push factors, pull factors, that range of different triggers for migration, there are a whole set of different issues that people bring with them, that people are thinking through, wrestling with, trying to resolve in their own lives. I'll just give you a moment to reflect on what some of those issues might be. If you were fleeing war, if you were fleeing persecution, if you were fleeing the loss of your livelihood, if you were travelling in order to marry or travelling in order to seek work or in order to be free, what kinds of issues might you be wrestling with? Here's a few that I've thought of. Identity. How do I define myself now? Now that I'm no longer the normal kind of person in the country where everyone is like me, but now I'm seen as a refugee. Now I'm seen as a migrant. Identity also a massive issue for the second generation and subsequent generations when they start to lose the language of their parents' home country and perhaps identify more with a kind of hybrid identity. I'm Afghan British or I'm Syrian German or whatever it might be. What does that do to identity? Issues of loss. Many people from Hong Kong speak about this, that you know, that just it was so achingly sad to have to leave, but they felt they did have to. But there's a big loss there. There's an emotion. There's a homesickness. There's a sadness. Language. You can't ask for what you want in the shop. People treat you like an idiot because you don't speak the language. You're lonely. Nobody understands you. But for some people, a sense of calling. Yes, okay, all that is true, but God has put me here and I'm going to serve him in this place where I've come to. Then these other kinds of issues that people face, employment, can they get a job? What kind of job? They might have been a qualified surgeon in their home country, but their qualifications don't count over here and they have to do something else. Racism, exclusion, trauma. Many will have seen or experienced horrible things on their journey, particularly those who make that refugee route. Church, are you welcome? Are you made to feel that you belong? Are you made to feel like an outsider? Culture, do people get you? Do people find your jokes funny? Do people enjoy the kinds of things that you enjoy? Do people eat the kind of food that you like? Can you get the kind of food that you like? Are your family here? Are you perpetually confused about how you ought to be living in this new place? All of these kinds of issues are issues for which the church needs to respond. So, to summarise that introductory statistical segment, we've got 281 million people, at least, on the move. Migration is a global reality, just as it always has been. And it's a reality in our neighbourhoods. There will be migrants of various kinds in neighbourhoods throughout the UK. So how should the church respond? In order to connect with this for a little while, I want to invite you to reflect on your own migration stories. Now, some of you may yourselves have moved from country to country. You may have been born in another country and come here. You may have moved for work and then come back. You may have people who've come as refugees or asylum seekers or as people moving for work or study in your church, in your neighbourhood. You may know people. Your church may be active in helping people. Just share how you connect to the issue of migration with one another, just in twos or threes around the room, just for a couple of minutes to make this personal. Okay, let me call that to a halt. I said it would just be a couple of minutes. It's good to see and hear so many conversations taking place as we acknowledge that, yes, this is something we can personally relate to. It is part of our experience, it's part of our communities, it's part of our church. It's a familiar issue. And so bringing that familiarity, those stories, those experiences, whether positive or negative, those experiences of the issues, of the push-pull factors, whatever they may be. Let's move on. I want to root our thinking about people on the move in the Bible. Because if you look at the Bible, you will see that from start to finish, it is a story of people on the move. As we look, just zooming in at a few stories through the Bible, I want you to keep these things in mind as you just kind of bring this lens to the stories that we're looking at. What is pushing or pulling the people in these stories to move? Why are they on the move? How did they manage to keep their identity? If they did, not everybody does. Is there trauma in any of these stories? Is there forcible displacement? Or are they choosing to go? So with those things in mind, let's have a look at a few stories from the Bible. Abraham and Sarah. I'll just read the text there. Terah took his son Abraham, his grandson Lot, son of Haran, and his daughter-in-law Sarai, the wife of his son Abraham, and together they set out from Ur of the Chaldees to go to Canaan. But when they came to Haran, they settled there. So Terah on the move. Doesn't tell us particularly why, but they left Ur and went to Haran along with Terah's son, grandson, and their wives. And then later on, the story picks up with Abraham. The Lord had said to Abraham, "Go from your country, your people and your father's household to the land I will show you." So here now he's leaving Haran and going on somewhere else again, leaving his father Terah behind him and moving on. And this time it's because the Lord has told him to. That's the reason he's on the move. That's the push factor. And we don't know what he might have felt about leaving his father's household behind and going on. But he goes. It says, "So Abram went, as the Lord had told him. And he took all his people and all his possessions, and they set out and arrived in Canaan." People on the move. Our story of God moving people on starts here. I mean, you could argue it starts earlier than this. You could trace migration right back to the expulsion from Eden. But here's the one I've actually chosen to start with. Another zoom in to another part of the Old Testament narrative. Hundreds of years later, Egypt. Remember the story of Joseph. Joseph trafficked as a slave to Egypt. But then in a position where he can welcome his father's family as honoured guests, and they come as honoured guests of a person in power. But then over the hundreds of years that they're there, they move from being honoured guests to slaves. Their fortunes fall. Their situation changes. This is part of their identity, and this is part of the identity that the people of God carried with them on into next parts of their story. So in Deuteronomy, when Moses is setting out for them the way they should live in the promised land, when they have their nationhood, when they have their identity, when they have a place to belong, he says, "Never forget where you came from. You come from migrant stock. You come from slavery. You come from that." And so they are told, you should say this. You should repeat this as part of your regular rituals. "You shall declare before the Lord, 'My father was a wandering Aramean. I'm a nomad by heritage. And he went down into Egypt with a few people and lived there and became a great nation, powerful and numerous.'" That idea of a wandering Aramean being part of their identity. And then, as we know in other parts of Deuteronomy, they're constantly told to remind themselves about how we were slaves in Egypt and the Lord delivered us. We are those who have been saved. We are those who've been liberated. We are those who've been redeemed by the Lord. That narrative of migration, of slavery, of liberation travels with them and becomes part of their national identity. Then, as we know, they settle in the land. But before that, they go through this trauma, this difficult time. The Exodus, that mass departure from Egypt, a great people movement. If you think of some of the images we've seen on TV in the recent years of caravans of people moving from Central America up through to the Texan border. You know, great trails of people moving together, or trails of people moving together from places where there's trouble in the east of Europe, in Asia. Here we have the origins of that, if you like, the archetype of that, a mass departure from Egypt. Thousands and thousands of people travelling on the move. 40 years of wandering in the wilderness. That too formed their identity. And then the conquest of the land, moving in to the land. And again, if we look at that through a migration lens, we have people who are immigrating into a country that was already occupied. And so we have tension, conflict between different peoples, those who are coming into the land and those who were already there. And that, again, is something that we see played out, don't we, across the world now as people move from place to place. And then, as they settled in the land, centuries of being there, occupying there, centuries of conflict with neighbouring peoples, with the other kings of the nations around them, as people moving through this geography, there's tension, there's conflict, there's trauma. There's all kinds of challenges. Later in their history, the 10 tribes of Israel, the northern kingdom, were defeated by the Assyrians and forced to leave their home and lost to history. The 10 tribes disappear, and we don't know what happened to them. So again, people forcibly displaced and not able to keep their identity as the people of God. And there are all kinds of myths and legends, aren't there, about where they went and what became of them. The two tribes of Judah remained for a bit longer, but then eventually they were defeated too by a different empire, by the people of Babylon. And the story of the exile is a story of suffering. So this image is a picture of the destruction of Jerusalem. You can see the smoke rising and all the people being marched off into captivity in Babylon. And the Book of Lamentations shows us the emotions that went with that. Is it nothing to you, all you who pass by? Look around and see. Is any suffering like my suffering that was inflicted on me, that the Lord brought on me in the day of his fierce anger? So being forcibly displaced brought with it all kinds of suffering, all kinds of trauma, all kinds of loss. And yet a key theological insight for the writer at that time and later is that this was judgment. This was the Lord's doing. And so even in that negative experience, the Lord was present. And then once they're in Babylon, they hear news from their homeland. And it's terrible news. It's traumatizing news. The sense of loss is reinforced again. In the 12th year of our exile, in the 10th month, on the 5th day, they know the exact date. It's etched in their minds because it was such a terrible day. It's like 9/11. They know this day when the news reaches them. A man who had escaped from Jerusalem came to me and said, "The city has fallen." And you can just imagine the weeping and the kind of the mutual consolation that they would have sought at that time as they mourned. There's nothing to go back to now. We're properly defeated. As they tried to live in exile, we again see some of these emotions. Psalm 137, by the rivers of Babylon, we sat and wept when we remembered Zion. How can we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? And that image is of the Hebrew people by the rivers of Babylon, weeping, hanging their harps in the trees. We don't need these anymore. There's no more worship now. We've got nothing to sing about. And yet Jeremiah sends a letter to the exiles, doesn't he, saying, no, settle, build, pray for the peace and prosperity of the city to which I have carried you, says the Lord. Settle down there, buy fields, build houses, marry, give your children in marriage. This is your place now. You have moved to Babylon and you need to find a way of being my people in Babylon. And then Ezekiel himself has this vision of God in Babylon. He says, whilst I was among the exiles by the river Kibar, the heavens were opened and I saw visions of God. There was a time when they had felt that by leaving Jerusalem, by leaving the temple, they had lost God. God had abandoned them. But no, Ezekiel sees this vision of God traveling towards them across the plains of Babylon and coming to meet them there. And so in these three different texts about the exile, you can just see the complicated mixture of emotions. The sadness, the grief, the weeping. Also the sense that, no, this is my home now. We need to settle down. We need to start to build in this new country. And then the fact that they can still know God in this new country is again really, really significant. And they held their identity. They strengthened their identity during that time of exile. And then the return from exile. And I always think of this kind of image of a motorway construction project when I read that passage from Isaiah 40. In the wilderness, prepare the way for the Lord. Make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Every mountain will be leveled. Every hole will be filled in. We're going to have smooth tarmac for our God to come to us. And so there's this return. They didn't expect it anymore, even though there'd been that promise given 70 years before. But there's a return under Ezra and Nehemiah. There's the rebuilding phase, rebuilding the city, rebuilding the temple. And they rebuild with a sense of identity that has been strengthened and kind of focused by the time that they had to differentiate themselves from the people around them in Babylon when they were in exile. So if you think back to those questions I asked you, the push factors, the pull factors, the trauma, the choice, the forced migration, the chosen migration, the sense of calling, all of these things are present in the Old Testament narrative of migration. When it comes to the New Testament, the migration story goes on. So the New Testament is set, obviously, in a time when the land is occupied by the Romans. And when we think of the Romans and other empire builders, we think of people on the move, people going and conquering other countries, imposing their ways on other countries. And that experience of colonization and occupation. When we read the New Testament, we're seeing that from the point of view of those who have been colonized, those who have been occupied in Judea. And there's this intercultural encounter. And again, thinking back to what Martha Fredericks said, we have to recognize that some aspects of intercultural encounter can be negative, can be stories of harm, stories of conquest, stories of destruction, whereas others can be stories of creativity and new opportunity. Jesus himself, of course, was a refugee as an infant, taken down to Egypt because of Herod, who was trying to find him. And when he entered into his ministry, it was an itinerant ministry. He moved from place to place, meeting people, relying on the hospitality of friends, sofa surfing, you could call it. He says, foxes have dens, birds have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. It's a model of someone on the move, someone who has experienced forcible migration, outsider status in a new country, a refugee, someone who is chosen to be itinerant as part of their ministry. And then when we think about the church's story is a story of movement, a story of migration. Right from Jesus' words to them at the Ascension, you will be my witnesses in Jerusalem, in Judea, in Samaria, and to the ends of the earth. You will travel. You will take this news. You will be my witnesses to the ends of the earth. And we see part of how that happened as the story of Acts unfolds. And after the death of Stephen, a great persecution breaks out. And Luke tells us everyone was scattered, all except the apostles. They left Jerusalem and were scattered throughout Judea and Samaria, taking the gospel with them, taking the good news with them. Mission and migration are intimately interconnected. we read that those who had been scattered travelled all over the Mediterranean region, Phoenicia, Cyprus, Antioch, and then some from Cyprus, from Cyrene, which is in North Africa, went to Antioch and started crossing cultural borders, preaching the gospel now to Greeks, to Gentiles, to pagans, as opposed to those with some Jewish roots. A story of migration, people on the move, taking the gospel with them. So in the Bible, we see a world on the move. I hope that point has been made. It's a story which has this as a kind of backdrop to so much of what is there. Migration is part of the identity of God's people. And we see how God works out his purposes as they cross borders, as they move from place to place, whether by choice or by compulsion. God is working out his purposes. God is making himself known. The gospel is going out as people move. Mission requires movement. Now, for many of us, it might not be traveling to another country, moving, selling our home, setting off. For some of us, it will be. But for some of us, mission will be crossing those cultural borders to the people in our neighbourhood, connecting to them, connecting to those who've moved and put themselves in a place where they can now hear. So how could these biblical perspectives shape our response to migration today? One of the things that we as speakers were asked to do this week was to show us Jesus. And so the question is, where is Jesus in all of this? In all of this great history, the biblical history, the history of the world, the story of migration, and all the emotion and upheaval and trauma and hope and expectation and excitement that goes with that. Where is Jesus in it all? I want to explore that partly through three works of art. Here's a stained glass window that has recently been installed in St. Mary Redcliffe Church in Bristol. This replaced what was called the Colston window, which was a stained glass window celebrating the slave trader Colston. You remember that statue that was thrown into the water in Bristol? Well, they also replaced a stained glass window which honoured him in this church. And the artist who was selected to produce the window made four different images of people on the move. And if you look at this one, where is Jesus? This question. Jesus is in the boat. If you look at the picture there, you can see three figures at the sort of right-hand side of the boat with halos: Mary, Joseph, and the child, Jesus. Jesus as a child refugee. Jesus as someone traveling to escape danger, to escape harm from Herod. And so the artist has imaginatively put him in the boat with the people. And I think there's something very powerful about that. As we move on to look at a couple of other images, we'll look at the biblical roots of this sense of Jesus identifying with refugees. Jesus the child identifying with the children who are in boats like that. Here's another one. This has recently been installed at the Vatican. And it's called Angels Unawares. And there's the artist, Timothy Schmaltz, sitting on the side of it. And here, the title comes from Hebrews, and that place where it talks about showing hospitality, because if you do so, you may be receiving angels unawares. So Hebrews 13, verse 2, do not forget to show hospitality to strangers, or by so doing, some people have shown hospitality to angels without knowing it. And so you see in this image a boat full of different refugees, different people on the move. And the artist has said that he's drawn them from all different parts of history, people of different ethnicities, people representing the great mixture of human experience of migration. And in the middle, you can see angel wings sticking up, symbolising the fact that, you know, you could imagine an angel being one of these people. By showing hospitality to people like this, you are showing hospitality to God. And then the third one, which kind of links back to the first one, another piece by Timothy Schmaltz. You might have seen this one as well. There are copies of this in many cities around the world. And it's called The Homeless Jesus. So it's a figure of someone lying on a bench, covered in a blanket. You can't see his face. What you can see is the holes in his feet, which shows us that this is Jesus identifying with a homeless person. Jesus putting himself in that position of a homeless person. And the inspiration for this is Matthew 25 and that story of, you know, when you fed someone, when you clothed someone, when you visited someone, you did it for me. And so that verse kind of sums it up. Truly, I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, you did for me. So, you know, although the homeless person is the image here, I think we can extrapolate that to also talk about the refugee, going back to the first of the images. Whenever you received a refugee, you did it for me. Whenever you showed kindness to someone who had nothing, you did it for me. And that sense of the radical identification that Christ has with people in need, in whatever kind of need, is something that these works of art explore. And I think that gives us really significant resources for thinking about how we respond to people on the move, carrying with them all that trauma, all that loss, all that sadness, all that hope. You know, we need to receive them as we would receive Jesus. So then, let's move on to migration and mission today. We live in a world that is on the move. 3.6% of people on the move in 2020, internationally, probably more now. Many of us have migration stories of our own. World Christianity is a product of this. The fact that there is Christianity all around the world is a product of the fact that people have been on the move. People have taken the gospel. People have gone to places where they can receive the gospel and then gone home. All kinds of stuff like that has happened. And so migration is a key aspect of life in the 21st century. I want to talk about it in terms of mission among migrants and mission by and with migrants. In other words, thinking of people on the move, migrants, as those who have an opportunity to hear the gospel, those who have the opportunity to challenge us to see God in new ways, and then mission by and with migrants, migrants who are themselves Christians and who are taking that with them as they travel. They are bearers of the gospel. Migration offers that opportunity for a really rich intercultural encounter within the church. And that's a massive gift to us. So I want to talk about it in these three ways: hospitality, partnership, and diversity. As we talk about this first one, hospitality, I'll give you a time to reflect on this when we've got to the end of this section on hospitality. But as we talk about it, think about how this might look in your church, how this might look in your network of relationships with people you know who are on the move in your community. So here we're talking about mission among migrants, people who've come to our country, and we want to be making Jesus known to them. If we want to root this in a biblical story, I think a good one is the story of Ruth. Ruth, as you know, is an outsider. She is from Moab. She's an immigrant. She's not one of the people of God. And she is a person who, when she comes back to Canaan with her mother-in-law, experiences great vulnerability and hardship. They have no provider. They are destitute. She has to go out and get grains of corn off the ground around the edges of Boaz's field because they've got no other way of supporting themselves. And so she comes as a person with need, person with weakness, person who is very vulnerable and who is an outsider in that community. But she is met by a righteous man. She could have been exploited in all kinds of ways She could have been misused. She could have been coerced into slavery. She could have, all kinds of things could have happened to her in that vulnerability. But instead, she is met by a righteous man. She is met by Boaz, who does the right thing by her, who works out what he needs to do to marry her so that he can provide for her and her mother-in-law. And because he does the right thing, she is integrated into that society and becomes part of the story of God's people. Her name appears then in Jesus' genealogy as the one whose grandson would be King David. And so she is someone who has come as a migrant and been integrated because of the actions of a righteous person. Martha Frederick says, migration has been an impetus for mission. Basic acts of hospitality to the stranger and care for those in need have always been an inherent part of how the church has understood its mission in the world. So as we show kindness, hospitality, welcome, care for those in need, we are making Jesus known. And that's part of how the church understands its mission. London City Mission have produced a helpful little booklet on how you can be a community of welcome. It's available online. The URL is there. But they talk about being a community of welcome in 10 points. Remember our shared humanity. I think that's the first point of all of this. We are all made in the image of God. We all share that humanity, however different we may seem. And so that's our starting point for welcoming people on the move. Pray constantly. Pray for them. Identify with their sadness, their trauma, their loss, their confusion, their loneliness. Pray for them. Extend hospitality. Invite them to your home. Invite them to your church. Listen well. Trauma hurts. And that's part of what many people may be bringing, particularly those who've been forcibly displaced. Love is practical. They say, what do they need? Do they need an overcoat? Do they need a saucepan? No, what do they need? Individuals become communities. So as you bring individuals together, they might come from different parts of the world, but they become a community of those who found a new family, a new place of belonging in your church. Count the cost. It's not going to be easy. There will be conflicts. There will be disagreements. There could be disappointment. Sometimes we will need professionals. They may need counselling. They may need help with asylum claims, these kinds of things. And then finally, we can do nothing without Jesus. I think that's a very helpful set of guidelines for how we can be communities of welcome. But I think it's also helpful to be aware of the fact that it's possible to do hospitality in a way that feels patronising and actually excluding, that makes people feel like they're still an outsider, they still don't belong. It's like, you come and we'll welcome you on our terms. You know, you can eat our food and welcome, you're very welcome. But, you know, there's a tension there. If someone's always just receiving and never given the opportunity to give, never given the opportunity to share something from their own culture, that can make them feel unequal and an outsider. And I think this is a helpful caveat that Dorothea Nagy gives. Hospitality sends an ambiguous message, simultaneously conveying inclusion and non-belonging. You're our guest. Well, maybe they don't want to be a guest. Maybe they want to belong. And so perhaps sometimes a better image of hospitality is the bring and share lunch rather than, you know, come and have a nice English roast dinner. Because that gives everyone the chance to contribute, to share something of themselves and of where they've come from. So how can we do this kind of hospitality well? I want to give you the chance at this point to reflect on how you think you could be doing this in your own church. Maybe as we've been going through, you can think about people who you know. How could you be doing mission among those people by extending hospitality and perhaps in other ways? So again, I'm just going to give you a few minutes to voice some of that to one another. I'm not going to ask you to do a full mission strategy in 3 minutes, but just to start to bounce some ideas around about what hospitality might look like in your context. Okay. Okay. Let's draw that to a close. I hope you've come up with some seeds of ideas, some beginnings of ideas of things that you could do to make people feel really welcome, to feel like they really belong. And only seeds of ideas, of course. I've only given you a couple of minutes to start thinking about that. But let me encourage you to keep thinking about that, to take those seeds home and plant them and see what grows in terms of ideas about how you can do mission among the migrants who live in your neighbourhood, perhaps through hospitality and perhaps through other ways. But we also need to reckon that many migrants are not people who are here wanting to receive from us, but people who can be partners in the gospel, a real partnership. So mission by migrants, mission among migrants. I've had the experience of being evangelized by a Zimbabwean missionary in Southend-on-Sea, and it was a delight to find someone who cared enough about the people of Britain to come and preach the gospel. I was able to say, yes, I do know about Jesus, and yes, thank you for sharing. But, you know, people come wanting to do mission themselves, do ministry themselves. Here, I think one of the biblical models we have is Priscilla and Aquila. Now, this is not a portrait of Priscilla and Aquila. It's just a portrait of a man and woman of that era. But I think I wanted an image, so that's what it is. Notice how much traveling they do, this couple. So Acts 18, verse 2, there, which means in Corinth, Paul met a Jew named Aquila. So they live in Corinth. But Aquila was a native of Pontus, which is nowhere near Corinth. Pontus is in what is now Turkey. And so they had moved to Corinth. But they hadn't moved direct to Corinth. It said they'd recently come from Italy, where they had lived in Rome, and then they'd been expelled from Rome because they were Jewish. So they'd moved from Pontus right the way across to Rome by choice, for trade perhaps, and then they'd been forcibly expelled from Rome, and now they were living in Corinth. And we know that they went back to Rome later because in the letter to the Romans, Paul greets them, says, you know, greet my fellow workers, Priscilla and Aquila. They were mobile Christian workers. They were itinerant. They weren't kind of going flitting from place to place. They were going and settling somewhere, staying 2 or 3 years, doing their trade, making tents. That's what they did. But while they were there, they built up the churches. They trained the leaders. They were doing mission. They were doing ministry as they moved from place to place. And Paul calls them his co-workers in Christ Jesus. So I think that's a model for Christian migrants doing ministry as they travel from place to place, sometimes traveling because they were forced to, sometimes traveling because they chose to, but always traveling with the gospel and traveling to do ministry among the people they were serving. Stephen Bevans says, Christian migrants themselves have precious gifts to give to the church, to form it more fully into the body of Christ in the world. They are a gift to us. What can these Christian brothers and sisters who join our churches, what can they contribute? What do they contribute in our neighbourhoods as they reach the people? And then the final point is diversity. There is something about the concept of the body of Christ that is intended to be diverse. I mean, the very metaphor of the body speaks to that diversity, doesn't it? Some of you are like a hand, some are like a foot, some are like an ear, some are like an eye, and you all need each other. You need those differences. And that applies to culture as well. People of different cultures bring different perspectives, different experiences of God as well as of life, different methods. We need to be communicating well within these multicultural environments. We need to be addressing the fact that there will be tensions and misunderstandings sometimes. Someone will get the wrong end of the stick or do something that someone else disapproves of. How are we going to deal with that well? How can we make this something that we celebrate and which expresses that deeply theological truth that the body of Christ is like this? Andrew Walls says the church must be diverse because humanity is diverse, and it must be one because Christ is one. He says the understanding of Christ arises from the coming together of these fragmented understandings that occur within diverse cultural specific segments of humanity. So someone from another culture will have a different understanding of Christ, which enriches and completes our own. And as we bring all these diverse understandings, our understanding of Christ becomes more whole. He says we need each other's vision to correct, enlarge, and focus our own. Only together are we complete in Christ. We need diversity. And to welcome that within our Christian communities is really important. We need to find ways of working together as intercultural churches. And that will involve inclusion. Inclusion in leadership. Inclusion in planning and strategy. Inclusion in patterns of worship. So we need to be asking ourselves questions like, who does the preaching? Who makes the decisions? Who leads the worship? Who welcomes others at the door? How many languages are heard? And if the answer to all those is the majority culture who are doing all of those things, then people are not seeing the diversity that exists. And people are not able to bring all that they have of themselves. And then we also need to recognise that intercultural church requires humility. We need to lay down our own preferences sometimes and let someone else choose a song that we don't know. Let someone else preach, bringing a different understanding, a different theology, perhaps. We need to make space for others. We need to involve them in every aspect of our lives as churches. And we need to respect and listen to one another. So I've talked about these three dimensions of mission among migrants. Mission among them, mission reaching out to migrants, mission by and with migrants as partners, and then the very kind of existence thing about being a diverse multicultural community. So I want to leave you with the question of what can we, as Christians in the UK, with all our own diversity and our own migration stories, what can we do in response to this issue? And specifically, what can you do? Taking those seeds of ideas that you might have started to think about, what can you do in your church or in your neighbourhood? Okay, we've only got a couple of minutes left, so what do you want to do?
I think we'll be asking questions.
Yeah, so come and see me at the All Nations stand. I'll be at base camp at the All Nations stand for the rest of the morning. And for those who are mission personnel, we'll be hosting the mission personnel reception later this afternoon. It'll be another opportunity to talk. So hope to see you then.